Hi, and welcome to Forecast, a show about climate science and climate scientists. I'm Mike White, Nature's editor for Climate Science. Today, I have for you the interview that I'm almost most excited about, but also the most dreading having anybody listen to. The good part is that I was finally able, during AGU, to interview Stefan Kropalet. Stefan's an incredibly nice guy, so nice, in fact, that he doesn't care that I'm horribly mispronouncing his name. But also, he's done a lot of interviews over the years, and so I was just thrilled that he was willing to spend an hour or so chatting with me. Of course, when I met him in his hotel, I forgot the right USB charger. This is really embarrassing when you're going to interview somebody who spends months in the Sahara and plans everything down to the most minute detail. I met Stefan, I guess, about 5-6 years ago at a Chapman conference in Santa Fe, New Mexico, on civilizations and climate variability. And he told me the most amazing story of fieldwork in the Eastern Sahara and some of the really harrowing problems he ran across. That story is in the interview, about 2/3 of the way through. Stefan is one of the only people still doing extensive fieldwork, climate-related fieldwork in the Eastern Sahara. He's taken cores from all over the place and has worked in places where no one has ever done science before. He's always sought out interesting and understudied topics and regions for his work and has a really unusual background, even for the scope of people I've talked to so far on the show. Grew up in Munich. His father was a political journalist. His mother was a successful lawyer. His grandparents were in the opposition against Hitler. He was thrown out of high school. He took that time and bought a VW bus and drove to India, where he met the Dalai Lama and lived in a refugee camp for a while. By 18, he was crossing some of the world's major deserts. And basically ever since, he's been going back to the Sahara. He doesn't publish very often, but he's managed to have a very successful career with just a few long grants. Not 5-year grants. These grants are 12 to 15 years in Germany that have kept him going for the duration. He's got long plans now for developing and publishing and analyzing some of the work he has backed up from the decades. But it's just an amazing story. And the whole thing gives me a sense of nostalgia for something I never experienced. You have the feeling that when Stefan retires and stops going to the field, that this kind of work is just going to stop, with a whole laundry list of unanswered questions that, probably due to lack of people going there to do science anymore and the terrible political military instability in the region, may not be readdressed for decades, if ever. That's the good part. The bad part is that I had some issues with my portable recorder, and I'm very sorry to say that the audio quality is not what I would like it to be. It has kind of a bad echo throughout the entire interview, and there wasn't much I could do with that in terms of post-production. I hope you can get past the audio quality of this. It's all fully comprehensible. And I think if you're able to kind of get past the first couple, 3 minutes, you'll sort of get used to it. And hopefully the material itself will be sufficiently interesting. As always, the opinions expressed here are mine and those of my guests. Thanks a lot.
Stefan Kropalet from the University of Cologne. Thanks for being on the show today.
Oh, my pleasure.
You were born in post-World War II Germany, I'm guessing in the early 1950s in Munich. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, 1952.
What kind of family did you have?
Oh, well, my family, my father was a political journalist at the Bavarian Broadcasting Corporation and later director, and my mother was a lawyer, one of the first and quite successful female lawyers in Munich. So was, and I was raised, or more or less spent my youth in the district or neighborhood of Schwabing in Munich, which is, well, similar neighborhoods in student places in New York or San Francisco. And so in a quite liberal environment. Well, these were adventurous days in the late 60s when I left school. And politically, around 68, and well, this was a big beginning, and many friends of mine from this period went into other direction, like Rainer Werner Fassbinder, the director, or Wim Wenders, the director, and many others who would, made completely different ways of life, but were in this small bunch of people who were active in this Schwabing neighborhood.
Growing up then, you were surrounded by, it sounds like, a pretty high level of intellectual diversity and stimulating conversation with your parents being in journalism and in law. Was that anomalous for your friends in the post-war environment, or were sort of the entire neighborhood involved in these kind of discussions and activity?
Political thinking and discussion, I think that was quite exceptional, because I think even at the age of 5 or 6, probably I started talking about politics in our family, and every evening my father returned and had some subject and very, very critical discussions. And so up to the present day, I think I'm often thinking against the mainstream. And I still probably I've inherited from my father, I mean, as difficult as it is today for me for writing scientific papers, mm-hmm. or as long time takes, I think I could write a political editorial every day within half an hour. So, but I went in another direction. I'm quite happy about that. But that was certainly a very political surrounding environment I grew up in. And that has also to do with that my father's father, he was in the opposition against Hitler, and he was married to a Jewish, or his wife was Jewish from origin. That means she had to hide more than 2 years in the basement, someone on the countryside in Bavaria. From this side, and he was also, his father was one of the participants of the 1918 short-term revolution after World War II in Munich. And so there was always an opposition background. And that was why, of course, that we were very critical of many of the first evolution after World War II. And that was also that I was quite engaged in student protests in the late 60s.
What were you protesting?
Well, of course, we were protesting against a new German army, against all kinds of laws which we thought are not democratic. And it went so far that I had to leave my school at a middle degree because of my political activity. That was because I was participating in demonstration, and so of course I couldn't go to school at the same time. So I returned, and so my parents were, of course, were fighting for me, and almost half of the my teachers were also fighting for me, but the majority were against me, so I had to leave the school. But that in the end was very good, because then I started traveling and did things like going from Munich to northern India by car with a old Volkswagen bus, which at the time has cost $50. So we were visiting the Dalai Lama and went to Meklutganj, into the Tibetan refugee village high in the Himalaya, at a time when we spent there 1 week at least, and we didn't see a single foreigner. And so there was a time, and I didn't take photographs today, probably might be a historical, but I think at that time few people knew the Dalai Lama. And so after 4.5 months, well, I returned and then did some more travel, started doing jobs, and then I went to Berlin, and where I got my high school degree practically earlier than if I would have stayed at my Munich school.
So you were expelled, did quite a bit of traveling, and then came back to school and graduated early.
Exactly. Well, there was a different system in Berlin, so I graduated earlier than if I would have stayed in my original school. And also, of course, I learned a lot, like languages and some other skills during the time, which helped me a lot. Well, in this special way of degrees, which was possible only in Berlin West, because in Western Berlin, which was an isolated city, of course,
yes,
most of the time I've been living there, they had all some special arrangement that means you could make one full year of school in half a year. And so I catched up very quickly and had even some extra bonus, so that in the end it was much better than if I would have stayed at my Munich school.
Berlin at the time must have been an interesting place to live in a divided city. If you were to contrast the intellectual climate that you experienced in Berlin versus in Munich, how are they different?
Well, normally Bavarians, people from Munich, they don't like Berlin and they don't go there. So I was one of the relatively few Bavarians at all in West Berlin at the time, because a completely different mentality between Southern Germany and this formerly Prussian Berlin at the time. But I loved the city because it was, I mean, I would say still it's the only real big city in the German-speaking world up to the present day. And in the 1970s and 80s, until the wall fell, of course, it was a unique city because it was maybe like Hong Kong, but that was even not divided in it. So it was really an island in a different, in the Eastern Empire. And so it had a very special thing. Of course, it was many young people, many old people. It was extremely liberal, maybe like a few other cities at the time. And it's still today, but in this time was very special. And then after the wall fell, there's a big change. So it became a very large city. And I still, if I would be young, I would still move there. But it has changed completely. But in this special isolation, it was really a very, very particular living style.
Then your background, you had parents and a family history of dissidents against the dominant governments. Mm-hmm. You were more or less expelled from your high school, did quite a bit of traveling for a young Metta Dalai Lama, lived in an unusual city in the world. Do you have any kind of a feeling for how those sort of experiences shape your ongoing professional willingness to engage in controversies and debate the dominant thinking about processes?
Oh, sure. I think that's for sure. I mean, even science, I often have very controversial discussions with my colleagues today. So we are very good friends very often. And that's nothing to do, I think, in science. One has to have discussions where else. And this is never personal. And some people react very sensitive, but I think the real one have a position, you can be best friends while you are in your scientific conclusions. You are really in opposite position. I think that also dates back from this critical surroundings I've been growing up. I've been also in an environment of people who later became big names, the filmmakers or theater people. And so I had really, a surrounding where some became very successful, other people dropped completely, other died even. And of course, it was a very, very special, especially even more than here in California, because after World War II, so it was really, so everything changed more or less in the late 80s and the early 70s. And there in Berlin, it was certainly the place to be at the time.
Your path to becoming the best known explorer of the Eastern Sahara wasn't necessarily straightforward. You had an interest in other careers initially. What were those like?
No, that's not exactly the case, because I remember well, and that's no retrospective falsification. I remember when I was, first of all, when I at the age of, I don't know, 5 years maybe. So my father made a small drawing to explain me, because even at the time, I wanted to become archaeologist. I don't know how that comes. And so he was making a drawing, a small sketch explaining the difference between archaeologist and astronomer and so on. And later, then I really studied hieroglyphs when I just, and was when first school classes. And I still remember every time I had geography lessons in my school, and I had the atlas before me, and my mind really drifted off on the map exactly to the place where I finally ended up, which is the southwestern part of Egypt, the western desert of Egypt in the Eastern Sahara. So that was really for sure. And of course, later influenced by films like Lawrence of Arabia, or reading the very old reports by Heinrich Barth, by Gustav Nachtigal, even Karl May. And so that helped to do it. And then my father once was with a later Chancellor Helmut Schmidt, who recently died, and they were good friends. And he accompanied him before he became Chancellor to Sudan. And there he brought some photos only and told me about the Darb el-Aba'in, which is a major East Trans-Saharan caravan route. And all these elements, they helped that when I turned 18, I took, for example, this car and went into deserts practically every year. That means, so my interest in deserts, I don't know exactly where that came from, but that's really from childhood. While the other activities were parallel.
Your first trip to the Sahara then was when you were 18 years old. Is that right?
No, my first deserts were 18 old. That was when we crossed the Iranian, the Persian and the Afghan deserts. And that were in Pakistan deserts and so on. That were my first deserts in the Sahara a few years later. Well, but anyway, that's now 45 years where I have practically every year I've been to deserts as a student in the university vacation and later, well, professionally since the late 70s.
What did you study for your undergraduate work?
First of all, in the early 70s, when I went to Berlin, I studied computer science. So I've been one of the very first computer science students of Germany. In 74, I was really, I practically packed my things to move to Berkeley, which would have made me really one of the early computer people in later Silicon Valley. But this didn't happen in the last minute. And that means, I finished my computer science study or almost, and then worked for a few years. And then only in 77, I started studying physical geography and geology. And that was then my, say, second scientific career, if you like. And that was right from the beginning. I went to the Technical University of Berlin because they made a former professor of mine. They had already started their research in the Eastern Sahara. That's why I went there. And so from the beginning, I was, academic environment, which was specialized on deserts.
I heard the talk you gave at the Long Now Institute, this interval talk you gave a couple nights ago during AGO. And I've heard you give talks before, but I never seen the kind of imagery that you presented during that talk. And it made me think about the kinds of questions that mountaineers and rock climbers get, which are typically on some order of, why are you doing this? You are engaging intentionally in an activity that might be quite dangerous, potentially fatal. Why do you do it? But that's always seemed like the almost an irrelevant question to ask for people who are doing this kind of work. First of all, as you said in other talks, it isn't necessarily any more dangerous than walking through certain neighborhoods in any kind of big city in the U.S. But looking at those photographs you presented of these amazing desert oases, these labyrinthine rock formations, the mountains, the volcanism, the solitude, the emptiness, the sky, the people, the camels, it almost made me think of have you ever thought of just moving there permanently as opposed to going on research expeditions? Have you ever thought about becoming a citizen of North Africa?
To the first part of your question, of course, I also have been only later, after decades, I've been thinking, or someone asked me, why do you do it? So, as you did, and there's certainly several reasons as always, but I think one is, of course, a curiosity not to do some research in a place where there already are hundreds of publications existing. So I could have done,
for example, Western Europe,
for example. And it was never my intention to make out of 100 books, 101st books. So I was always attracted by, say, the last remaining regional frontiers, especially in the Sahara Desert, and just to going there and looking which is really originally new. And so that was the chance that we were practically the first who went into many regions of the Eastern Sahara, of Libya and Egypt and Sudan and Chad. I've been always in love for deserts. Why? I don't know. But I think one thing is, of course, I like the people there. So in the real desert where we work, there are no people. There's population density zeros for 5,000 years. But I love the environment and I love this sort of absolute freedom. Because once you leave the last village and you go into in the hyper-arid court of the Eastern Sahara, I mean, there's nowhere on earth more liberty and freedom than there, because you go where you like, you can do your camp where you like, you can take samples. There is no authority whatsoever. It's far away and you are, of course, living under very harsh conditions in a small group, but in that way, you can walk, you go to places where never ever someone put his feet during the past 5,000 years since the Sahara turned a desert. So that's certainly one of the motivations.
When you return from the desert to Cologne, I can imagine that there must be some sort of lengthy readjustment process going from the desert back into this intensely urban city. going from complete freedom and complete solitude to a culture that has, compared to that, vastly higher levels of societal controls on your individual freedoms, your ability to travel, to live. Your living space is much more constrained. Psychologically, what is the readjustment or the reentry process like for you when you go back to what we would call civilization?
Now, that's a very, very good point. Second part that's refers to your previous question. Of course, as you said, well, would I like to live always in Northern Africa? I think if I would belong, that's certainly not. I mean, spending the whole time in the 12 months, a year, first of all, it would be impossible to do that, because, well, you can't live in the desert permanently, and even the Bedouins and the nomads, they return to other places over the year. But so what I like, that's really the contrast of spending a couple of months every year, of course, only in winter time, in the Sahara Desert with population zero, living under very harsh condition. We live on maximum, more or less, 1 gallon per day of water, which must be good for drinking, for cooking, for toothbrushing, for washing, and so on. There's no more.
Do you actually wash?
Well, it's difficult. It's hardly. I mean, we spend months without a single shower, and maybe once a month we take one bucket. But you would be amazed how you can wash with half a gallon if it's well done. There are some techniques, and so, and you don't get dirty. One must say, one day in New York City or any major city, you get dirtier than in a few weeks in the Sahara, because this is sandy, but it's not dirty. So real dirt is not, unless you work like me. Well, sometimes in old mud deposits. Then of course you get dirt, but it's natural dirt, so that's not a problem. And of course it's extremely dry, so there's no sweat and so on. That's not the big problem. But you live mostly on the same. So one evening you have noodles, the next day rice, the next day noodles, the next day rice. It's a very simple food. You live outside on the ground, on, for several reasons, we don't use tents on the ground. Usually the whole night it gets very cold in the desert, and just in your sleeping bags, and in the morning sometimes you have small dunes covering your sleeping bag. If it's cold, you can also have a sheet of ice around, so etc. Many, you live in extreme group situations, almost like astronauts, because of course you can make a night walk. Sometimes you don't find your way back, but anyway, so you're in a group situation, but at the same time you're in the car, you're working, and then you return to Western civilization and you open the tap and you have endless water which you can drink, which no desert dweller could just dream of. And you go to a restaurant and you have all the facilities, and if you have something, an emergency, in 5 minutes, a quarter of an hour, you are in the best hospital. While there, if something, the next doctor is 1 week drive away, there's no way to get rescue, and you're really fully dependent on you. And if you get bitten by a snake, you die. While here, you just call emergency and you are, so I like the contrast, and in the same way psychologically, because the 1 or 2 years I haven't been in the desert during the past 45 years, I was really missing something, because once you're in the desert and you feel the wind, you feel this endless space, you are surrounded by some 360 degree surrounding, you turn around, you see the horizon, there's nothing except maybe in some places some scorpions and some snakes, but that's all. And then you return to here, and where one of the major problems today is finding a parking lot. So I like the contrast. That means every time, first of all, when I return from the desert and I enter, for example, the first villages or even then the capitals like N'Djamena or Khartoum or Cairo, or if I approach the Nile Valley, I don't like it at all. So I would love to turn around. But at the same time, of course, I'm thinking about my family, about my children. That tears me home. And so I'm of course, once I'm really there, I'm sitting in the airplane back, and then I get out of the plane, I'm happy. Before, sometimes it took quite a while until I got accustomed again to this Western way of life. Today, well, you open your email folders with all which has been accumulated during 1 or 2 or 3 months, 2 months. And now today, I don't do 6 months anymore. And then you're back much quicker than you used to be before. But anyway, I like the contrast.
You've been involved, of course, in climate research. But in hearing you talk over the years, it's clear that you're not just a climate scientist. You're also an explorer. You're an archaeologist. You know a great deal about cave art, You're interested in human migration. A lot of this is centered around the controversies of the African human period, the post-deglacial time, so after the Younger Dryas, the greening of the Sahara. And you've had debates with people like Viktor Brovkin in the Pages of Science, and with Peter Domenical, famously, people coming at it from the ocean perspective, where you're working in the Eastern Sahara, and you're making the argument that there is a lot of spatial variability in the greening and the degreening of the Sahara, and that it takes place slowly over time, and that the evidence we have archaeologically and from cave art and all the evidence from the pastoral societies indicates that it wasn't a rapid threshold response. It wasn't a tipping point or an abrupt change. Why does a large section of the paleoclimate community still feel that there was an abrupt change in the face of the evidence that you presented?
No, exactly what you say. First of all, if you go to these remote places where practically today nobody goes anymore, and not even before, then you can't be too specialized, or you shouldn't be too specialized. That means you have to have a general approach. That means you're taking notes, you're taking samples, you're taking photographs of everything you find, even if that's not exactly your field. And so you find archaeological site. Of course, you don't drive by. You find rock art. You don't drive by. You find maybe some insects or last remains of more recent fauna, or you find a meteorite, or you find geological deposits. You're recording everything. That means that's where there are. Sometimes I'm taking along colleagues who are extremely specialized, and they just go out of the car if there are some plants or if there are some special rocks or if this or that. And I try to take everything just to get most out of this quite demanding.
Just because you're interested, or because you have a sense of responsibility that there may not be somebody there again for another decade?
Yeah, both, but at the same time, it serves a good thing. And I think as every minute is precious, and every expedition takes a long preparation. And really, sometimes I would say it's 1 week for 1 hour of serious field work, because it takes weeks to get to the places, to return and so on. And so I try really to make best of it. And there's not a minute, except when we have lunch or dinner, where you don't do anything in research and so on. So I think that's important to take back, because you never know if anyone will return to such a site during the next years, decades, maybe ever. Centuries, ever, possibly in some places. And it doesn't get easier to work in the Sahara. And the other aspect is like my friend Peter Domenical, we meet tomorrow for lunch, and this discussion, it's a scientific discussion, while we are personally very well friends, like with Viktor Brovkin or Martin Clausen, where we all have the arrangement. And of course, his conclusions, they were based exclusively mostly on one single oceanic core, which was taken south of the Canary Island. And he was looking for special indicators, which he interpreted as being indicators of a really abrupt change, first of all, from this post-glacial hyper-arid conditions where the Sahara was much bigger than today, and then was supposed to turn into this green Sahara, and the same thing at its end. And while we working in the field, we have lots of field data and evidence accumulated during the past, soon 40 years, which tell a completely different story.
And what is Peter's response when you debate these issues?
Well, of course, I think he has already, he sees, complication in his hypothesis, which is, of course, highly cited. And so, of course, one line of argument is that, okay, maybe in the western part of the Sahara, it was abrupt. I think nobody's talking anymore about a few decades, but anyway, it's still 100 years would be extremely abrupt, even 300 years, even 500 years, even 1,000 years would be abrupt to turn the entire African continent or the Sahara, which has the size of the United States, into a desert or first produce the green Sahara within a short time. So I think that's more or less out of the actual discussions. But of course, one line of arguments is by Martin Clausen, as by Peter, that they consider the results of our core in the Unyanga Lakes in northern Chad, that they are rather telling the story of the Eastern Sahara. Some even say just a local signal which happened around this now groundwater supported lakes. And in the Western Sahara, it should have been completely different. I also would say that there's really enough data from the Western Sahara to tell a completely different story from the French colleague who have been working there for almost 100 years in some places. And there's no more research for some years, but before. So I would say even for that, it's hardly conceivable that there was anything like any abrupt forming of the Sahara. And that's why I always say you need terrestrial data, paleoclimate data, because while humans are living on the continents and the oceans tell their stories, glacial evidence tells its story, but man is neither fish nor penguin, and that means you need to get results from where the people have been living and mostly will be living in the future. And there I think we have evidence in the Eastern Sahara, which is not only based now on this one single core from the Unyanga Lake, which really is unique, I would say, not only in Sahara, but in the continent of Africa, but also the archaeological data in the Eastern Sahara, where I've been working with many archaeological colleagues since 1980, which show a very gradual movement of the prehistoric population from starting, say, what is today southern Egypt, to the places in northern Sudan, like Darfur, where they're leaving today. And even this evidence would be completely different if there would have been anything like an abrupt aridification or desiccation of the Sahara, because then there would have been population and suddenly 50 years later none. And that's not the case. There was a very, very slow movement towards the south. And these, the prehistoric people who tried to survive by special means like digging wells and so on for some time. And when the groundwater was no more at reach, then they had no choice either to stay and die of thirst or to move. And that's what they did. They were following the retreating monsoonal rains to the places where they are still today, where they can live with 100 millimeters or 150 millimeters of rainfall a year.
Through no planning of my own, I've had now three discussions about the African human period. The previous two were with modelers. I would talk with Betty Otto Bliesner and with Gavin Schmidt, both of whom have worked on African human period topics. And it still seems like the basic forcing that they talk about in their models is the changes in orbital patterns. The insolation change is driving the northern extent of the African monsoon. But the models still can't get the monsoon as far north as it appears in the observational evidence. Is your sense that the orbital changes were the main driving factor, or do you think that there were substantial interactions with the human communities that could have accounted for differences between the models and the observations?
Well, first of all, it's already one has to think about this term African humid period. I mean, nobody would talk about American humid period or American climate or European climate, because there's a big difference between the Canadian border or say even northern Canada and Central America, thus in Mexico. So even the term, I think, is not very conclusive.
Do you have a preferred term that you think should be used instead? Or
it would be good if one is much more regional. I mean, Africa is a continent with 30 million square kilometers. And so certainly the climate has never changed at the same time everywhere, from Cape Town to Cairo. This is to be excluded for many reasons. As I always say, one could only speak about the beginning and end of an African humid period if there would have been a meteorite impact, or there would have been a gigantic volcanic explosion, or there would have been anything like that. Then it would be possible to say that this had an impact on the entire climate of the African continent.
But it's really a misleading term.
It's a misleading term, yes. I would say one should be much more regional and say, well, about Saharan climate change, for example, and Central African climate change and Southern African climate change, because this was very often not in line, as we know. That means when the Sahara was relatively green, the southern hemisphere deserts in Namibia, they were drier. And then when the Sahara was desiccated, then it became more humid in the southern hemisphere. So again, this term, but as it's so good, many scientists used it because it sounds good. But in the end, I think this term is misleading from the beginning. To respond to your question on the reason, of course, I'm no astronomer, but I've been in touch with many, many leading astronomers who've been, like André Berger, who have been recalculating the old Milankovitch curves, which with the several cycles. One thing is, I would say, is for sure that it's not just orbital factors who produced the Sahara as or turning it green or yellow again, which must have happened, I would say, at least 20 times during the Quaternary, the past 2.5 million years.
During all previous
periods. During all previous periods. And I always said that 100,000-year cycle, that was always the weakest one, and that's what is maybe fits best with a big deviation of could be 10, 20,000, 30,000 years, but which fits best. While for the 40,000 cycle, I have never found any evidence on the ground. And then it's the short cycle. Of course, I think that the insulation, or say the global warming after the last ice age, after the Younger Dryas, this was really the main reason why there were more rains on the continent, especially in the Sahara. In my point of view, very simple fact, there was a global warming and there were more evaporation over the oceans and there was an intensification of the monsoonal system between the continent and the sea. And so this water vapor from the Atlantic Ocean, from the Bay of Guinea, was pushed much, much forward into the interior continents than before. And I think that's what I see from the geological record, where there is in fact nothing to be discussed, because if you find lake sediments, if you find river deposits, if you find archaeological sites, and you can date them through charcoal, which is gives very precise dates, then this is evident, these are facts.
It's completely undebatable at that point.
That's undebatable, I would say. And because we know when the lake started, and we know when these many thousand lakes, of course, we've been studying maybe several hundreds in the Eastern Sahara, we know when they started and when they dried out. And that's evidence. And now I leave it well to the modelers and to the astronomers to see whether that fits. Another big question is, of course, that in practically all models who have been done by tens of institutes worldwide with very high funding, they all take 6,000 years before present. That means 6,000 years ago as the basis for doing them as a time slice for modeling.
And but the regional greening began 8,000.
Much earlier, even 11,000 years before present, 9,000 before. And I think there was a big error to select, especially what concerns the Sahara, to select this time slice. And once all the modelers did it, of course, the following modeling used it too. And just because this is supposed to be the maximum of insulation during summertime in the Northern Hemisphere, and especially over the Sahara. So that was practically this time slice, I think. I tried to do what I could more than 20 years ago to push them a bit earlier where there is more evidence. And that was the time when the Sahara was really green, when there was a maximum in lakes, in river, in population. So this would have been much better to make a comparison between the ground data and the modeling, while 6,000, when this was already the beginning of the desiccation in the Sahara, which started in Egypt, or what is today Egypt, around 6,000 years ago. And so even that, it shows that insulation alone can't be the only factor, but there must be non-orbital factors which made the Sahara greening. And I would say there, that was the onset of global warming, which turns the Sahara green.
You mentioned how 1 hour of fieldwork can take a week of planning. You're in the field for a couple of months a year or more, which means that a huge chunk of your other time is involved in preparation. You've been doing this for decades, as you mentioned, and you've been doing it in a way that hasn't really been coupled with the traditional way that scientists show that they're doing stuff. You write high-impact papers, you've published in Science, the top specialty journals, but you don't publish very often. And I feel like when people are starting their careers, they feel like they have to publish all the time, multiple papers per year. You've made the most recognized career in Eastern Sahara work by not doing that. Is that purely a function of time for you? And how have you been able to support your work? And has that been enabled by having the right kind of university environment to let you do that in that way?
Yes. No, that's completely right. I would say there are several factors. Well, maybe one factor has been I had too good funding. That means since 1980, I had support from the Deutsche Forschungsgemeinschaft. That's not directly from the universities, but through so-called collaborative research centers, which are more or less the highest level of funding you can get at the universities, which provide, if you do good work and you review it every 3 years, now every 4 years, and if you do good work, you have a perspective now until 12 years, before it was until 15 years long, and I was lucky to be a member of 4 such long-term projects, which provided a long perspective.
48 years of funding through those 4 programs. Is that, or I guess
yeah, exactly,
more.
Yeah. I mean, there's some, one was parallel, but I mean, since 1980, I was lucky and the only one as I switched from the University of Berlin to the University of Cologne to be work within such long-term research projects, which were always funded. Well, paper-wise, of course, it would have been much better, like some French colleague, like some formerly British American colleagues who got funding by NSF for a couple of years, and then they were at the institutes and they wrote one paper after the other. Well, I never had the time because I was obliged but happy to do field work several months a year, which takes several months of preparation, several months sometimes of after work. And I was, of course, I could have said, well, I skip one expedition, but you have to take care about PhD students. You are, well, of course, once you get the funds, you have to turn it in and so on. And so I was very lucky that the reviewers, well, they trusted in me and said, no, sometimes it takes longer. Sometimes I find other things than the things I was looking for when I wrote the proposal. And so that was very good that they trusted me to the present day, and they didn't check well how many papers I produced. Well, my intention was, as I never had the time, and I'm a slow writer in science, as I explained. Well, I wrote few papers, but which had quite a big impact. And instead of writing many other papers, which take a long time, and the second reason, of course, is fieldwork takes very long, preparation takes very long, but at the same time, the analysis, lab analysis, which require many specialists who normally, and there's very few left today, who you can trust, for example, the interpretation of all these biomarkers, like the pollen, like diatoms, and so on. There's hardly a handful of specialists on Earth who you could trust, and they have usually their own projects and so on. So that's always takes sometimes year to get. We had one paper with specialists from Canada, Pierre Francus, who took almost 10 years until publication after we took the core.
Just to do the analysis on the
just
core.
To do the analysis, and it's a tedious work, especially well with our Lake Yua core in Unyanga, where we have 11,000 years in subannual resolution, which makes 25,000 single layers, which theoretically you could analyze each layer for itself, and you would have the best climate record ever done, I would say, anywhere on the globe. But if you think that one pollen analysis, a good one, takes 1 day, and even the subsampling of millimeter single layers can take an hour and so on. So that means you can calculate 25,000 work days just to do the pollen, 25,000 work days just to do the diatoms. And so this is very time consuming, and that leads, and then to having together a multitude of international scientists who are also very busy. So it takes much, much time. Time which the modelers don't need. They feed their computers, they run for a couple of weeks or month, and then there's results, next paper can be started. And that, of course, it's not comparable to field research and lab research. And
what that means is that if you were a US citizen and you had been living in the US, having the same interests, you never would have been able to maintain this career. You would have gone through your first 12 or 15 year program, and the NSF program managers would have looked at your renewal application, then they would have said, no,
Possible. It's very, very much possible. I would say, on the other hand, if I would have been, and I think today or maybe not too long until my retirement, and I might take some invitations to American with pleasure universities to write maybe all the publication. I didn't have the time or write books and whatsoever. But on the other hand, of course, I'm quite sure that I would have found some third party private funding of this research. Like Fred Wendorf, who was one of the leading prehistorian, U.S. prehistorian, who also has been working, spent all his life mostly in the Egyptian desert, and he was mostly funded by private Texas billionaires. And I'm quite confident that I would have taken one of these people who I got to know some now, to the field. They would have been inspired, and this would have provided me with the independence. So surely this NSF, normally the projects which I also have got for reviewing, they are just a few years only, and there we could never have made what we have done, because this really needed 30 years just for this geoarchaeological publications and other ones who then, well, are now high impact citation papers. But that, of course, requires decades of work. We could never have been done, and this where I spent probably up to 10 years in the field, and many other colleagues who changed with every project. There's year, decade-long man hour or man day or women day research in the field, and that nobody could have done in short-term programs. And what more, so I would say such a research will never be done again. I think now today, for political reasons, security reasons, where we could freely move from Egypt into Sudan, we spent several months in Sudan, returns.
Those days are gone.
Virtually, these are gone forever. And I think nobody would be still in the mood or be ready to do such a work for many months every year. There we have to wait until there will be robot-driven research like on planet Mars, and maybe they do it solar-powered. And
they'll be making Eastern Sahara landers.
Exactly. That's probably the next step. And so there we are very happy for this German funding, which I was most happy being member in four different of this project. Most just made one. Some
you did. Four.
Most were already happy to were fed up with this, well, difficult working conditions, but as I always loved it, so I was really happy to spend my whole career in the same region, the Eastern Sahara, which of course is as large as Western Europe. It's not a small desert, so and there's still to do for many generations to work in the same region, more or less in the same direction. Sometimes it's an emphasis on geology, sometimes emphasis on climate change, sometimes more on archaeology, but generally in the same region with the same focus, and that's really a unique opportunity. And I hope there will still be some synthesis papers and even books coming out at latest or only after my retirement.
You've been going, as you talked about, for decades now, and of course you can imagine anyone listening that the field work is not necessarily always easy. When I met you in Santa Fe a few years ago, you told me the most appalling story of fieldwork I've ever heard in my entire life. Yeah. I'm sure you have many like this, but this one really stuck with me over the years. And it's the one where you were drilling in a lake and the local population felt that you were not necessarily engaged in a purely scientific endeavor. What happened at that time?
Well, that's a sensitive issue because, I don't want to go too much into detail in respect with my host country Chad, where I'm really now supported from the president to the local people and everyone, and they do the best I could ever had in any African country, maybe Sudan as well, but mostly this is really unique. This is one of the most isolated villages well, probably on the globe. For example, when we went there in the late 90s, there was a teacher who was sent from the capital N'Djamena there to do teaching for the local children, and he didn't get his pay for 10 years. He was lost. There was no way. Nobody sent him money. There was no way to return. They didn't have a single car. So he was fed for about 10 years by the local population and he got stuck there. So that was the situation when we came there. And of course, the people who live there, it's the poorest of the poorest, and underwent all terrible things like the war with Libya and the many mines which were left when the Libyans left. So yes, there are still children today who lost their legs or their hand or other things, or even die because of these mines, which will probably in many places will never be demined because the area is so large and nobody knows where they were put by the Libyans when they retreated. And so they're extremely laminated and they're really living almost in a state like in the Middle Ages. They live on dates and water and that's almost everything they have. And if they get a piece of meat once every 6 months, that's good. And so these are really people, I don't blame them. But of course, we were drilling. We were drilling on this lake on a small platform, which we brought there for weeks like slaves. The lake is 25 meters deep. We did, drilled into with always lifting a 30 kilogram hammer up, falling it down. And so at the end, we had a penetration depth of 1 millimeter. And of course, for one of the people who looked at us, it is unimaginable that someone does this extremely hard work just to get some ancient mud out of the bottom of their lake and to reconstruct paleoclimate. Yeah. I mean, it took years and I managed with endless conversations with the chiefs there, with a typical tradition. They're still sultans. They're still, which is much more important than the official government in the remote capital of N'Djamena, which is, well, unreachable.
So you were going back to the area over the years and talking to.
Exactly. So I did, I really did my best. And so I know three ethnologists who know this special language because these people, they don't speak French like many do in Chad, and they sometimes don't even speak Arabic. That means to communicate with them, it takes sometimes two interpreters to tell them the story. But in endless meetings in the sun, in the heat, where the whole sheikhs were assembled. So I tried to communicate it to the chief, and I think they understood the story. But unfortunately, twice when we did the coring, top of the local hierarchy, he was not there because he was also sick with spirillosis and so on. So he was in treatment. And so there was more or less an increasing situation that they're saying, get away, you are thieves, you're looking for gold, you're looking for this. And then, of course, some said we would be making a hole at the bottom of the Unyanga lakes. And so, like in a bathtub, we make a hole and so the water gets away, which is the basis of life. Or some other said there's a virgin at the bottom of the lake hidden, and there's still a fisherman waiting for her and we would kill her. Or others said, well, they would have a headache since we started drilling because, well, the gases would come out. And of course, they still have a special mentality and they ghosts are still a very, very real thing to them. Over the days and weeks, they said, get away, until where there was a moment where suddenly they all approached us, and that was really tough. And luckily, well, say, rather in the last moment, we were rescued by the sous-préfet, say, by the sub-governor, who we reached. We couldn't reach him by satellite phone, but by one guardsman we had, and he made his way and during the time. And so, well, we made it. And unfortunately, the same story happened again 6 years later, when the same constellation, if there would have been the chef de canton, the mayor, and so on, they would never have dared.
But the people
they
were gone, the people with whom you've been negotiating.
Exactly.
They weren't there when you're doing the work.
Exactly. And at the same time, even there in these remote places where there is as this century-long tradition and this follow-up, and I think a basic democratic system, more or less. But even there's now conflicts between the younger men who now some, it's a generation conflict. And then, so they took the opportunity to aggress us when the big chiefs were not there, or there was only the older brother of the main chief, and he was not respected. And of course, the ones who came to us, these were all, children, young men, very young men and women. There were no, more aged man with whom one would have, I'm sure I could have managed to talk to them. But in this, and there were, of course, as always, there was one or two really tough who wanted to cause these problems, and the other were following, and they had a long time to prepare them and to talk them to coming. And against children and women, you can't do anything at all.
Not only is field work in your study areas incredibly difficult, the possible area of field work is rapidly contracting. The countries where you could even think about doing this kind of work, I believe, is now limited to Chad. You're nearing the end of your career as an employee of the German university system. I know you have to retire officially in just a couple, 3 years. When you stop, if there aren't people that continue the work that you're doing, what do you think are the big science questions, the big climate questions that will remain unanswered in the near term? That could have been answered if you'd had better access. I mean, the things I think about are comparisons of the current, the Holocene to previous interglacials and trying to disentangle the human side of this equation. But to you, what are the big questions that might remain unanswered?
Oh, there's still a big bunch. There's still endless. I think there's still room for generations of fieldwork. If you compare it, for example, to the American Southwest, I mean, where there are tens of thousands of publications, surely, and there's hardly a few on the Sahara based on field work, at least. And if you think that the Northern Chad, an area the size of Germany, that's more than 300,000 square kilometers, where virtually there hasn't been any research done except the few surveys I managed to do there. And even in the Tibesti Mountains, where, well, I did early this year, and I will return early next year. And so I always say now we sent a probe to a comet 500 million kilometers away to take samples, to analyze them. And in the major crater of the highest mountain of the largest warm desert on Earth, nobody has ever taken samples before at the bottom, which is most interesting. And during the last trip, we only succeeded to take a few using camels and in another crater, even donkeys. So the whole core of the Eastern Sahara on the Libyan and on the Chadian side is virtually unexplored. And nobody knows what's waiting for us there in paleoclimatology, in archaeology, even mineral resources, in botany, in remaining wildlife, which is probably very, very, very last species such as Adax, which are still living there. I've seen traces and even them in life. And so there's endless much to do. And I will certainly return even after retirement. And then concentrate on this practically virgin white spots on the map, which remain in the northern part. And of course, once we hopefully finally, ultimately have published the first splash paper on the Unyanga core, then of course we are a big step further, and we can use this data and this age models to recalibrate all the work which has been done during the past four decades and putting them in a reliable time scale. And that will also help to reinterpret all the work we did, the archaeological radiocarbon dated work, but to recalibrate all this thousand data which were based on carbonate datings, and now with this age model we can put it, and there must have been an error of up to 1,500 years, which will then tell a completely different story in many respects, and what concerns, for example, as well, dramatic changes in the climate, which we will present from the Unyanga Lake in this hypercontinental position far away from the ocean. That means if you find anything of an abrupt change, then it must really have been an important one worldwide and not concerned only the Northern Atlantic or say Northern Europe, if you find it there. And if you don't find it, then it might have been an important climate event elsewhere, but not there. And so there's still endlessly much to do, but one must go, one must do it. And I'm very, as you mentioned, very pessimistic for the next years and decades. And that's why, well, practically there's nobody else doing fieldwork anymore. And I have big problems of finding colleagues who are ready to come along, even if they like, but their family, their wives, they're against it. And then normally they decide to stay with their wives and not
choosing their wives over you.
Exactly.
Stefan Kropelin, explorer of the Eastern Sahara Desert, paleoclimatologist, archaeologist, and looking forward, hopefully, to the next generation of people who will be able to take on the challenge of working in the Eastern Sahara. Stefan, thanks very much.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Great pleasure.
And that was Stefan Krobelin from the University of Cologne, recorded with me, Mike White, Nature's editor for climate science, during AGU 2015. If you'd like to learn more about the show, you can check out the blog at forecastpod.org, or you can find it at iTunes and on Stitcher. Thanks a lot.